So, this month we've been talking about practicing in ordinary life, how it shows up, mainly through two prisms, suffering and mindfulness. Thinking about it, you could think about it as the two wings of the Dhamma, and the first half of this month we talked about the wing of compassion. This half of the month, this ending part, we're going to talk about the wings of wisdom. So I thought, though, I don't know if I necessarily think about suffering in a different way. I think sometimes it sounds like I talk about it a different way. This idea of just kind of holding suffering as it is and not worrying about it one way or the other. But I get a lot of questions and emails about how do you hold this suffering? How do you hold that? And so before I go to talking about wisdom, I want to see if I can make a little bridge here. I always have trouble trying to answer that. And I couldn't really figure out why I had so much difficulty answering this question of, you know, how do I hold obsessive thinking, or how do I hold some kind of intense emotion, or anxiety, or panic? How do I hold that? I mean, I hear a lot about holding it, and how do I do it? How do I hold or deal with this, you know, obsessive worrying about the past or the future, you know, or just all of these self-images that we have? And I couldn't really understand what I was having the difficulty with until I had this awakening moment when I was talking to a friend of mine. And the problem is the word how. That word implies that there's something we need to learn how to do. I need to learn how to do something, and then when I learn it, then I'll know how to handle this. And we keep looking for that how. But there is no how. There is no how in this path we're on when you enter into this noble search we talked about the last couple of weeks. There's no how. There just is. There just is suffering, which is what I think that was the uniqueness of what Buddha was saying in the Four Noble Truths, is that it's not a how do you process through suffering. It's just this capacity to learn how to acknowledge that suffering is here. That's it. Once you learn how to acknowledge that suffering is present, then the wisdom aspect of the practice takes over. There's no we have to deal with suffering. That's probably the biggest and the hardest thing to learn in practice. At least it was for me. It took me forever, because the whole point of practice to me for many, 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 many years was somehow or another I had to figure out how to stop being so anxious, how to stop being so reactive and angry, and all of these so-called negative things about myself that I hated. How do I become a better person? And how does this practice make all that work? Okay, I know how to sit, but how does it work? That's what I want to know. What do I need to do? And therein lies the problem. There's no doing here. And I think I'm hoping tonight we can talk about it in such a way that it helps us understand why it's important to begin to let go of this idea that we have to do something in order to make this practice work, or this practice won't work unless I learn how to do it. We're not trying to eliminate suffering in any way. We're not trying to create some capacity to let it go. We just need to see it. You just need to be aware of it and investigate it. Compassion is the practice of choosing to stay with suffering. So for the first half of this month, it's about all the different ways we can choose to stay with suffering. We can notice it's there and choose to stay with it. And we don't have to change it at all. Wisdom is what arises when we clearly see the ending of suffering inherent in the suffering. So we choose to stay with it, and somehow or another, inherent in the staying with it, there is an ending of this suffering. All you have to do is see this a couple of times, and that's it. I'm not doing nothing. I'm not touching it no more. You know, we kind of get it. But the most difficult thing is trusting our capacity to stay with it and not do anything before the wisdom begins to set in and we see it happening, this ending of suffering happening more and more. So tonight we're going to talk about what is the bridge that helps us see the ending of suffering. And that is what I call the continuity of mindfulness, this kind of capacity that we have. Ability, it enables us to stay with suffering until we can see its ending. Buddha said, or Joseph Goldstein is quoting something that the Buddha said, and Joseph said, one of the most radical, far-reaching, and challenging statements of the Buddha is his statement that as long as there is attachment to pleasant and aversion to unpleasant, liberation is impossible. That attachment and aversion is what is driving our wanting to know how to deal with this suffering. So if we could find a way to just be with the suffering, whether it is attached or averse, just be here with it and see it, then maybe something could shift for us. I think that's where the wisdom comes into play. So what we need, I would think, is some kind of far-reaching practice. Like last week, or the first week in this series, we needed a noble search, meaning that if you're going to sit and be with suffering, you're going to make this choice to be with suffering, it needs to be a noble search that you are investigating into it. Because if it's just the run-of-the-mill, I'm just going to sit with my pain kind of stuff, you know, we've all done that, tried that. It just doesn't, have any, there's no honor in it. No glory in the fact that, you know, we can sit with a lot of difficulty and pain. But if you're going to sit with suffering, and there's a nobility in this, a search in this that carries with it some kind of sacredness, some kind of meaning out beyond ourselves, out beyond our own life, some bigger, larger connection, then it's totally worth going into it. You know, we can all go into it with both feet, eyes wide open. Likewise, the type of practice for wisdom is a different type of practice. It's not a therapeutic practice of, oh, I'm going to try to understand. It's much more of a far-reaching capacity practice is what we're building. Capacity to be able to do this. Something I think about, if everybody in this room, you know, if this capacity had something to do with everybody in the room, and I think sometimes it could be because I'm African American, I don't know. But it seems to me I'm not going to get my fair share. Like if it's about me, if this practice of wisdom, this gaining wisdom, is going to come from my own individual efforts, I'm not going to have a lot of faith that I'm going to get my fair share. It feels like life has just been so unfair to me in so many circumstances that I have this sense that I'm going to have to fight for it. That I got to do something different, or I have to be better, or work harder, or something I'm going to have to do, or it won't come to me as easily as it comes to other people. I can remember when I was in law school, I had to work so hard. I mean, I didn't understand half of the cases, and I'd have to read the things like 9 times just to try to understand it. It just was such a difficult process for me. And a lot of my friends, it came so much easier for them. Now, I don't harbor any, you know, craziness that it wasn't hard for a lot of people. But my point is that I always have this thought that it won't be good enough for me, that I won't get enough. And so if this far-reaching wisdom is going to come from my efforts, then I have a problem, because I'm already behind the eight ball the minute I start practicing. But thankfully, it doesn't come from me. Hopefully by the end of the night, you will all see that it does not come from us as individuals. There's something else there that we are trying to access. It's sort of like this mindfulness practice kind of turns on the light so we can see suffering for what it really is. Suffering, the end of suffering, it's the same thing. It's just like a coin, right? Heads, tail, same coin. One is heads, one is tail, but it's the same coin. Or you could look at something in the front or in the back. It's the same object. There's a front, there's a back, there's a left, there's a right, but it's the same object. And likewise, beginning to see that suffering is the same, whether it exists or it non-exists. Both is the same. Buddha said that the whole secret to existence is to have no fear. Never fear what will become of you. Depend on no one. Only the moment you reject all, only the moment you reject all help are you freed. That's kind of a strange quote, so I'm gonna read it one more time. The whole secret to existence is to have no fear. Never fear what will become of you, and depend on no one. Only the moment you reject all help are you freed. So that's what we're going into in this far-reaching process, this far-reaching practice. This is the wisdom that we're going to try to see if we can tease apart this evening. And I want to start with where my heart lies. I want to start in the place where I believe this is the only way to get to this far-reaching practice, and that's with metta. And I do not want to talk about metta as something that comes from the heart, because I think when we attach metta to the heart, we create this quality of metta that somehow it's going to create a nicety with us. It's going to make us nicer. Even when you go on a retreat and you listen to people talk about metta during the one metta sit we have all day, all wisdom practice, and then metta. Everybody talks about this quality, this sort of, I'm trying to be nice and connect, and somehow metta is supposed to be some kind of warm and fuzzy kind of happiness that exudes all in us, and we're all you know, plump and fluffy. I just can't get into that. And I hope to put that idea to rest and put another word with metta so that we can connect to metta in a completely different way. Think of metta as being capacity. That's it. It is the only way we have the capacity to do this work, to do both the noble search and to have this far-reaching practice. It's only through metta that that happens. It doesn't take much. We go out in the world and it's full of negativity. It's full of a lot of anger and pushing and shoving and trying to get our way. It's like there's a roller coaster going up and down of all this emotional energy. And if we try to just sort of do that how, watch it and fix it, then we are caught in the roller coaster with it. And metta, I'm hoping I can show you tonight something completely different that is not, at least from my perspective, that is not what metta is. The first time I ever connected to metta in the way that I'm talking about happened at this really, really difficult retreat I was on. I don't know if I've told the story before. I may have. I know I wrote it in the newsletter years ago because it was so shocking to me, but it bears repeating. I had this really, really difficult retreat. It was an emotional whirlwind, and it was very unpleasant. So I'm sitting here crying and crying and crying in the back all the time because I'm so miserable and I'm so angry and I'm so disappointed. And it was a retreat with Rodney and Christina Feldman up at Loon Lake in Canada. It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful retreat that we used to do those retreats. I don't know, some of you may have went on it. But this retreat in 2006 was horrific. I had never had a retreat that was so emotionally taxing and disappointing to me. So I used to, you know, the cushion sitters were all in the front and I'm way, way, way in the back. And Rodney would walk all the way down to the back and give me the thumbs up, thumbs down. And I would be like, don't ask me. This is so terrible. I hate this. Why did I do this practice? Now, I don't think I knew anyone. I mean, I may have seen people from Sims, but I didn't know anyone at that retreat. I never spoke. We don't speak at these retreats. You know, it's all quiet. You don't know anybody. You don't talk. And you're back in the back crying. What is that? So I go into the lunchroom, the dining hall, and I'm eating this meal. And something happened. I could hear all the little clanging dishes, and I could hear people eating quietly, and I got this sense, this overwhelming sense, that I was in this room with all these people, and we were all interconnected. We were all struggling. We were all having difficulties at different degrees, but there was a sense that everybody in the room was connected to one another. We were a part of some bigger thing. And we were all just quietly eating together. This overwhelming sense of love and compassion for people in this room just came out of the blue. A sense of just so much caring. And I felt very safe and connected to all these people, even though I'd never spoken to none of them. I had one friend there. We were roommates. But, you know, no talking. And here I was, so connected to about 150 people. So I go back to my sit, and here I go. Soon as the lights go out, and eyes close, back to the tormenting story yet again, and I'm sitting there. And I remembered that feeling in that dining hall. I remembered that sense of connection in the dining hall. So I'm sitting here, and instead of me feeling the same old edge of anger and frustration and why me and I'm tired of this, something else happened. I felt the sense of, oh, this is part of the normal process and just being with this, holding this. I'm sitting here with all this compassion and this capacity to just sit there. I kind of begin to feel all this gratitude for being able to be at that retreat, for seeing this, for noticing something. I'm here at this retreat. And this joy rose in me, and for the rest of the retreat, I was kind of able to find this deep samadhi, this deep stillness for the rest of that retreat. So when I came home, go back to work, everything is the same old, same old. I'm walking to work, and then it hit me that what happened to me in that dining room was metta. Not the kind of metta that I'm going to do my metta practice and I'm going to get my beneficiary, my benefactor, and my good friend. It wasn't that. It was metta, just pure metta. This kind of deep appreciation, a deep connection to something other than me, that I had tapped into a capacity that enabled me to go into the hall and deeply hold and look at difficult things. Not because I was doing some metta practice, but because I was connected to metta. That metta is the capacity to stay there with difficulty. I was stunned. I had never thought of metta this way. It wasn't that metta was some secondary practice we do after we become great at all the watching the breath. Metta is the only way we're going to be able to watch the breath. It's a softening. It is a kindness that we show to ourselves when we're sitting there with some difficulty. It's the capacity to be kind in the midst of some difficulty. What Jack Kornfeld called it is, in deep self-acceptance grows compassionate understanding. It's that deep connection to this, to something else that's not me, that enables me to hold the difficulty and suffering. The emotional wisdom, this is something else Jack Kornfeld said. The emotional wisdom of the heart is simple. When we accept our human feelings, a remarkable transformation occurs. Tenderness and wisdom arise naturally and spontaneously. Where we once sought strength over others, now our strength becomes our own. Where we once sought strength to defend ourselves, we laugh. It's in that capacity. But you won't be able to find it. You won't be able to find it if you practice this metta by trying to do some practice to make that metta exist in any moment. The metta I'm talking about shows up when you're willing to just be with whatever the difficulty is, whatever it is, we're just going to be here and just let it be without trying to fix it, make it go away. Which brings me to this second thing that you kind of need, I think we need in order to do this. We don't talk about it so much in urban practice, but the second thing I think we need is a far-reaching stillness, which would be seclusion. To practice seclusion in an urban householder life. So I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about. If you imagine suffering like taking a rock and tossing it into a still pond, everything was fine. Then we throw the rock in there, and of course there's all this ripples. Our reactivity, our first thought, is to try to smooth it out so we can get it back to this smooth pond. And that trying to smooth out the difficulty is making more and more and more and more ripples. And we keep trying to get to the smooth pond we once had, but we can't. And so this seclusion would be like pulling ourselves back. The pebble gets thrown into the pond and we're just still with it. The ripples are going to be there, but if we just stay still with it, the ripples will eventually just fade out and we will have our still pond again. So it's practicing the ability to just observe what's happening instead of having this need to do something to fix it. So a lot of times we think about seclusion in terms of monastic life or when we go on a retreat. We think, oh yeah, I know what that seclusion is. I go away and I do my retreat or have this monastic life. But as a householder, I have to go to work and I have to do all these things. There's no seclusion. We can't do that. And it's part of the difficulty trying to practice and have this far-reaching practice when we don't sort of cultivate this seclusion in our own lives. So I thought I would take a little bit and tell you about three ways to practice with this seclusion. But first I want to give you a quote by Joseph Goldstein. He says, the mind is restless, unsteady, hard to guard, hard to control. The wise one make a straight like a Fletcher straightens an arrow. How good it is to rein the mind, which is unruly, capricious, rushing wherever it pleases. The mind so harnessed will bring one happiness. Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own unguarded thoughts. A well-directed mind creates more happiness than even the loving actions of your parents. That's what we're doing. We're guarding this mind. We're taking this unruly mind, this unsteady, restless, hard to guard and hard to control mind, and we're applying both the metta and the seclusion in order for that kind of guardedness to come. So three ways we can do this. One, it's a daily practice. Somehow or another, there's a daily practice. Somehow or another in your practice, it's having that capacity to be still by yourself, sitting there secluded. You see, when you sit there in your daily practice, it is the practice of actually allowing the mind to come back to stillness, to come back to stillness, to not push against whatever it sees. We can do that when we're sitting still. When we're practicing, when we know we're practicing sitting here, even if some of our most worst difficult things show up, we know this is practice. We just keep reminding ourselves, this is practice, this is practice, I'm just watching this. But when you're going about your life, running here and there, taking care of this, taking care of that, and that nagging obsession keeps showing up with you, you can't put it aside. It just influences everything. It just gets into the very nature and fabric of our lives, and it begins to consume everything and take over us. So once a day, we set aside time to practice, hoping that obsession is going to come up. Because if it comes up, we can sit there with it and know that we are practicing, steady ourselves, and practice this letting go. I think I have come to this conclusion that the mind is kind of a it's kind of an alarm clock. I don't know if I want to call it an alarm clock. It's sort of like the keeper of me when I'm lost in something else. That's what I think mindfulness is, not the mind. But when I get lost in thoughts, just think about this for a minute. When we're sitting here meditating and we're lost in thought, something wakes us up, right? We don't do that. We just wake up and notice that we're lost in thought. And then, of course, we can turn our attention towards the practice again and go back to the body and go back to our practice. But it's the waking up. That's the most important thing. Something wakes us up. And that is mindfulness that wakes us up. So what it would be like is, when you do a daily practice, is you're putting a little money in the bank so that the mind will wake up more often. You're putting a little money over here. So think about that thing that you obsess over. I have several. And it just spins in the mind over and over and over. The thing you don't want to do is sit quietly for 30 minutes with that obsession, right? You don't want to do that. But that's where you need to sit with it. Because either you sit with it for 30 minutes in practice, or it will walk with you everywhere you go, the entire 16 hours you are up walking around. It's with you, walking around with you, poking at you. And if you get too involved in something, it'll poke a little louder just to make sure you haven't forgot. You know, you haven't forgot that this thing is coming up. Remember this thing that's coming up that I've been telling you about all day, every day. But the alternative is seclusion, meaning that you go, you sit down, you take that obsession, and you sit there with it for 30 minutes, or however long you sit there with it, in practice, not in some kind of trying to bat it away. I went on a hike one time. I don't like Spray Park. That's the hike I went to. And it's like this beautiful place, but I have such a negative reaction to it that I probably never can go to Spray Park again. But you go down this long hill to go down into this valley, and then it's this long, beautiful path, well maintained. And it just so happened on the day that I went, my friend and I, it was full of bees and full of mosquitoes. And I didn't know that bees had like territory, right? So you're walking along and all of a sudden this bee comes up to you and it's like it's trying to tell you, you're in my area, you're in my area. When are you leaving? Let's get out of here. You're in my area. And I am swatting these bees around, which is upsetting them, I think. It's like I think they're laughing at me. So they call their friends, and then everybody's coming around. Oh my God, it was so hot, and I spent the whole time fighting with the bees, and I know they were laughing at me. So now I have this judgment about it. But now whenever I have any kind of obsessive thinking that won't go away, and I feel myself swatting it, trying to get it to go away, I'm like, nope, 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 nope. We're going to sit down right here with that thought and look at it clearly. Because it's the swatting that is actually trying to get the ripples out of the water without thinking. We're trying to get a clearer mind. We're trying to get the bees to go away. We're trying to get this thinking obsession to go away. And finally, my friend said, Tori, if you just leave them alone, they'll just come up, speak to you, and you just keep on walking. I couldn't believe that. I mean, they did. They didn't do anything to me. It was just the idea that a bee is so close to me that I'm afraid it's going to sting me. So a daily practice is really, really, really important towards seclusion. It's not just can you be peaceful and kind and can you learn how to be all mushy and nice. It is the only way we can practice, well, it's one way of practicing seclusion. Another way is we are fortunate to have days of mindfulness and residential retreats, non-residentials, but you go to those and you spend a day. What would it be like if you committed a day a month? That's what I propose, is a day a month where you actually just sit all day and go in and out of sitting and walking and sitting and walking. But people may not be able to do that. So what would it look like if you spent or committed one non-residential a year, one or two? Like, you know, you just actually say, I'm going to do this. In this commitment to be at a non-residential and spend the weekend going in and out of this seclusion, seeing as part of an urban practice, bringing that seclusion in. And then the third way is you look for seclusion, what I call seclusion opportunities throughout the day. So seclusion opportunities would be having a day of silence. This is quite intriguing if you decide. You know how we sometimes say, okay, I'm going to some religious faiths, they will have, what do you call it, a fast. So we could have a day of silence instead of a day of fasting. And the way that looks is that you spend the whole day just not talking. If you have to say something, even at a retreat, if you have to say something, then you talk. But otherwise, it's the chatter, the gossipy, unnecessary talking. That's what we let go of. We let go of the need to have that all day. And instead, you watch how the mind and your impulse to talk, to respond, to say something, even when you don't need to say something. Even when you don't have to say something, you are going to want to say something. And it's watching that. So your day of silence. Another way you could think of, I told you about my monastic friend Vimala. He says he wants to create a concept called quiet spaces, so that you could go into a restaurant and there would be a quiet table and everybody would get used to this table being the quiet table. So we could do that in theory by ourselves. We could just create quiet spaces. Imagine if your kitchen was a quiet space. So when you're in the kitchen, there's cooking and there's washing dishes and there's doing those kinds of things, but there's no talking, which means also in the mind, you don't use the kitchen as the place that you get lost in your mind while you go about your duties. You actually do the duties of the kitchen in the present moment. It could be the bathroom, the bedroom, whatever. It's just that you designate a certain space, a quiet space. And that quiet space means, just like at a retreat, that you're trying to guard your senses even from the distractions of the thinking mind. And then the last sort of way you can do this is just pick some times where you, you're just quiet and observe. So many of you know that I picked, Rodney kind of challenged us on that, and I picked 5 minutes before the hour, whether I was in court or not. And I would not, I used that as just being quiet, tired. If I was in the middle of examination on some witness, I would always look down at my paper and pretend like I'm doing something, watching the clock, like trying to, like, okay, oh, just a minute. Trying to just, you know, bide my time so no one knows that I'm trying to be still for 5 minutes and not talk and just see if I can observe what happens. The idea is really just more about actually taking this idea of seclusion seriously. I have another quote from Joseph. He says that having been through both of these other stages, our mind matures to a place where it is no longer moved. It does not grasp at pleasant things. It is not repelled by unpleasant things. Our mind attains deep, deep balance, like a calm, deep flowing river. Out of the mature place of equanimity, out of this mature place of equanimity, the conditions arise that open our mind suddenly to the unconditioned, to what is beyond body and mind, to what is freedom. So this freedom that we're sort of looking for is all in capacity. And that capacity comes from practicing the connection of metta, that deeper metta. A way to think of that deeper metta, I didn't really say it, but what I wanted to say was it is acceptance, another word you could think of it, capacity to hold the difficulty, be still with it, is a way to think of it. It is in our connection to whatever is difficult. And in seclusion, this sense of actually protecting the mind, the thinking mind, and encouraging the thinking mind to wake up when we are asleep. And then the last aspect that I think in this kind of far-reaching practice is what I would call far-reaching wisdom. It's this capacity to allow whatever is arising to arise, allow it to happen. Tara Brach said, nothing is wrong. Whatever is happening is just real life. I like that. So that's what we're doing. We're just learning how to live real life. Just whatever's happening, just allow it to be. When I first started practicing in this idea of just allowing whatever happened to just happen, I used to always think, this cannot be true. That's like allowing abuse to happen. That's just allowing somebody to mistreat me or mess over me. I don't want to be in a practice that just sort of allows all this stuff to happen. Just allow whatever, just allows it. But the word allow is sometimes gets a bad rap, just like metta does. The allow, I think, that's connected to a far-reaching kind of practice is not this allowing of the thinking mind. It's not the judging the conduct. The allowing of this far-reaching practice is more of being able to bear witness to what's actually happening, to be present and attentive to the reality of what's going on. In fact, I think if I had been more aware and willing to actually be and allow my true understanding, I would not have lived in near the level of abuse and mistreatment I lived in for years. Mostly, it came from not looking at it, not wanting to see whatever difficult situation I had. And by not wanting to see it, then I basically stayed in it. Joseph says that not seeing dukkha is dukkha. And much of my suffering came from my inability to see it. Because it's kind of scary if you think about it, right? It's scary to see this stuff that show up in our lives. It's scary at the idea that we'd have to respond to some of the things that show up. But the allowing that is in this far-reaching practice, this wisdom, is a different kind of allowing. You allow it to be there so you can look at it steady and clear. You have this practice of seclusion and metta, and you can stay with it no matter how difficult it may be. And when you stay with it, you see it clearly. There's no question here. When the first time I ever saw a relationship that was abusive, I didn't have any problems getting out. It was the inability to see it in my previous relationships that I kept spinning around in it and spinning around in it, and I wasn't sure. I think it might be a little abusive. Maybe I shouldn't stay with this guy. I don't know. I think he's doing his best, spinning around. But when I finally took a good long look at it, I didn't have any problems leaving. I would have done anything at that point to leave because I saw it clearly for what it is. So the allowing that we're trying to do with this far-reaching wisdom is to see what's actually happening in reality and not from some shielded, rosy kind of way of faking our way through the difficulty. And the one main thing that we have to see is this chokehold that has us around I, me, and mine. This chokehold that the idea that somehow or another life is somehow directed by me, for me, and on my behalf. And life doesn't really live that way. In order for us to live that way, we have to completely ignore all the things that happen to us that we didn't have any control over. You know, we really want to go around, I want to go around and think to myself, oh yeah, I got that job, because I'm just so good like that. But it's not me getting the job. I mean, I was sitting here when I was preparing for this, thinking of all the jobs I've ever gotten, and every job I've ever gotten, I would dare say that every job that everybody in this room has ever gotten, somebody else had to do it. Somebody else had to make that decision. And it could have went this way or it could have went that way. Because we don't think of someone made the decision to hire me. We think, oh, I got that job. I did all this work and I made it happen and I got that job. So this idea of letting go of power, letting go of control, it sends all this fear in us that somehow or another I'm going to lose something, I'm going to be less than, I'm not going to be at my best. But when you start practicing with letting go of the I, me, and my, you can begin to see that things actually happen with or without my I, me, and my. In fact, I have less stress worrying over whether or not something's going to happen when I take the I, me, and my out of it, this requirement out of it. Someone mentioned to me, I think maybe last week or a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine said, Tori, I've noticed that your teaching is getting much better, and I'm very proud of you. And I thought, me too. But the problem is that what this friend doesn't know is the panic that I am sitting in. I have to walk from Capitol Hill down to the center because I am so full of anxiety trying to get down here. I have to shake off all this extra anxiety because I come from a world full of trauma. So my mind's go-to place is I'm not good enough, it's not gonna work, nobody's gonna like me, it's all trauma, it's all catastrophic, it's gonna be terrible, this is gonna be the worst talk ever, just be prepared to worry, it's gonna be the worst. That's what's going on in my head all the time. It's always there. I call it this trauma mind. Anybody that ever came from trauma, that's the mind's go-to energy all the time. But when you take out the I, me, or my, then it isn't about whether I do a good job, whether I do a bad job. It's being able to appreciate the capacity to just step into the Dhamma, relax into the Dhamma, and let the Dhamma just share and talk as it needs to. And it doesn't have to be about me. I give up the praise, but I also give up that blame and that negativity and grumbling about how it should be. In the long run, what you end up with is way more flexibility, way more capacity for confidence and courage. It's just something that you just begin to have this capacity above and beyond what you thought you would be, what you thought you were. And that wisdom doesn't come from me convincing myself, finally deciding, finally believing that I'm okay, that everything is okay. It's not like I let go of my sense of inadequacy. It's there. But I know how to tap into metta and seclusion and not let the words and thoughts and ideas distract me. Last quote. Oh no, I have two quotes. First, this is Jack's. Most of us spend our lives caught up in plans, expectations, ambitions for the future, in regrets, guilt, and shame about the past. To come into the present is to stop the war. That's what I believe that. That's what happens. I stop fighting with all of the mind's thinking process and what happens with the thinking process. Tara Brach puts it another way that I like also. That happiness lies not in finding what is missing, but in finding what is present. So that's where we're going with this whole process. That's where we're going. We're going deeper and deeper and closer to the present. And we can do that not by figuring out how to do it, but by being willing to just be still and waiting. Be still, watching, allowing whatever is to be so that we can connect with it and see it for as it really is, softening around it. And just watching it. Watching it change, watching it rearrange, just watching it. That's it. So thank you for your time.